This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So my mother, who was from Toronto, where I grew up, was a primary school art teacher and a former athlete. And my father, who is behind the camera here, the box brownie, was an industrial paint chemist. Neither of my parents had beyond high school education, but our house was full of books. And we also had this property in the Caledon Hills, not too far outside Toronto City, where we spent all summer when we weren't on camping trips and every weekend throughout the year. And that's including the Canadian winters in a two-room cabin with no electricity, running water, or telephone, as it still exists today. So from a very young age, and also, this picture is staged because my parents believed that young children should be kept out of doors and unsupervised as much as possible. So my mother did read to me, but only at night after dark when we were allowed back indoors. So I wasn't the most socially skilled kid. And so I got used to spending a lot of time, you know, walking or running or biking by myself, arguing with myself. And come to think of it, that's scientists do a lot of that. So thanks to the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, where I grew up, I fell into a mineral collecting group. And as a teenager, I became an ardent mineral collector. And a friend of mine and myself are collecting rare earth minerals in Southern Ontario. Rare earth minerals aren't rare. Just the child labor laws prevent them from being economically mineable because they're it's micro mining. Okay, and we could make a lot of money mining rare earth minerals on a weekend, which we sold to Ward's Natural Science Establishment in exchange for mineral specimens from all over the world. So as a result of this, in fact, this mineral collecting habit, I decided I wanted to be a geologist when I grew up, but I didn't really have any idea about what geologists did, and I certainly wasn't going to learn that in school. So at the end of my freshman year at McMaster University, I went to the professor and said, are there any jobs? Are there any summer jobs doing geology? And he said, yeah, there are jobs. You can work for a field party up in Northern Ontario making geological maps. Okay, so the Ontario government, and as I didn't know yet, but the Canadian government also sent teams of professional geologists out with student assistants to make geological maps, you know, covering large areas. And the idea was to encourage mineral exploration and also be able to advise policymakers as to what's out there, you know, what kind of resources, you know, actually exists in the country. And so that first summer, I spent 4.5 months in northwestern Ontario, land of lakes, in a paddle canoe and walking through the bush. And, you know, biology began with anatomy. Okay, you dissect organisms to try to figure out how they work. Okay, and geology is the same way. It's the anatomy of the Earth's crust. And we don't have a scalpel, but we use the natural erosion to expose a surface that we can walk around on and look and reconstruct. And because of deformation and projecting and whatnot, you can build up a three-dimensional picture. And as a field geologist, you're trying to continually test your three-dimensional picture of the structure and the origin of an area by summing up everything you know, including what you just learned on the rock you're standing on, making a picture, thinking, which of all the rocks out there, you know, should I go to next? And that has to be the one that would be most devastating to your picture, your model, if it isn't what you predict it would be. And I'd like to think I've never gone to a rock without an expectation of what it should be, okay? And so I loved it because this was the act of science in real time. You know, synthesis, hypothesis, and test, you know? And I've done some of this geochemical stuff where you have to, you spend weeks in the field collecting samples and you have no idea, what the results were going to be. And then months later, you get the analytical results back from the lab, which immediately suggests the more samples that you need to collect. But you're not in the field, so you can't collect it. It's so frustrating. But doing geological mapping, you're actually doing that science in real time. So I just decided this is what I want to do. Now, when I was a student, the textbooks all said, at least the American textbooks said, that continents and oceans are primordial. And mountain ranges form along the margins or the borders of the continents, like the Cordillera or the Appalachians, because of stresses that are built up at the interface between the continents and the oceans. Right? But it doesn't work very well for Eurasia, because in Eurasia, all the mountain ranges are in the interior of the continent. Okay? And then during precisely the time I was at university, 1980 to 1987, was the plate tectonic revolution, which transformed all of Earth science through the realization that the ocean basins are transient. They rift and open, and then they close, and continents collide, and the continents are moving around and continually rearranging themselves. Okay? And so, of course, that makes Eurasia understandable, because Eurasia is a composite of many different continents, constituent continents, that were formerly independent, which came together at different times, and the mountain ranges form the boundaries between these formerly independent continents. Those are the mountains are where the continents collided and were deformed, like when you have two cars collide, they get deformed. And they get thickened, and so of course the surface sticks up. Most obviously between India, which is the latest arrival, forming the great mountains of the Himalayan ranges. So the question that I asked myself was, well, how far back in time has this plate tectonics business been going on? Okay, the plate tectonics in the original revolution said it looks like it's been going on for the last 400 million years. But in Canada, most of the interior of Canada is this big pink blob. And most of those rocks are between 2 and 2.5 billion years old. And it's just a big blob. And so the question that I said, aha, I'd like to see whether this is also an aggregate like Eurasia formed at some much older time. So the first thing I had to do was to see whether there were boundaries in here that represented old continental margins. So I skirted around, read lots of literature from different areas and whatnot, because I've always been very particular to pick the right field area to, for a purpose and to pick the best possible place. And so I decided that this little brown patch right up there looked pretty promising. And it wasn't very well known as recently as 1958, which is only a decade before I started working there. This region was unmapped. All we knew was that there were sediments, old sediments that were folded up here, and there were volcanics that were also folded here in Great Bear Lake, but what went on between was unknown. Before I started working there, there was a helicopter reconnaissance mapping project where they just grabbed samples on a grid. So we got to know broadly what kind of rock, where was granite, where was sediment, but nothing about the relative age or structure. And so, of course, this is 300 miles from the nearest civilization. There are no roads, there are no people living there. And so we were flown in on old single engine Otter, and we would unpack our camp, myself and three or four undergraduate students, maybe one graduate student. And then we would camp for 3 weeks. And during that 3 week period, we would cover as much ground and map as large an area as we possibly could by walking on foot and using little rubber boats. And then when we couldn't reach anything anymore, then the plane would come in, move us to a new area, we'd do the same thing. And we'd get started as soon as the snow started to, be small enough snow patches that we could actually see the rock. That would be at this latitude, the early part of June. Would be when we could first start working. And then we'd work 24 hours of daylight, so we could do 20-mile traverses every day. And we worked until the end of August, which is when the snow starts to stick again up in the Canadian subarctic. Okay. And what we found is that those sediments, those beautifully folded sediments up in the eastern, northeastern part of that area, it's an old continental margin. You can see the rifting, the rift volcanics, the sediments of the Atlantic type margin. It's all beautifully exposed there. The duration of the margin during its passive stage is 132 million years, which is indistinguishable from the average age of much, much younger passive continental margins. So everything was pretty familiar. We could even tell about things that were going on at much deeper levels in the crust or over our heads that had been eroded. There's a great thick pile of volcanics that because of inclination to the north, you can see exposed north of our area, but have been removed by erosion. But they're fed by these things here. These are cracks that were filled with liquid rock, which then crystallized and hardened, and it resists erosion and makes these walls that look like veins. And in fact, they are like veins. They're feeders to this great stack of lavas above our head. This is the area over by Great Bear Lake in the western part of our area. You can see the small trees coming in, but these are volcanoes. You can see entire volcanoes, large stratovolcanoes that are all tipped up, and you can see it in cross-section. You can see all the internal plumbing, and as you can see, there's rock everywhere here. So it's just a paradise for geology. And now, of course, walking 20 miles every day, it helped that I had a side career as a distance runner. But the athletics informed my science in unexpected ways, okay? So the first year I ran the Boston Marathon, 23 years old, old John Kelly was almost 60 and he ran under 3 hours. And I said to myself, I should be able to have a long career as a field geologist. Because most field geologists in my day, you know, they retired from field work in their early mid 50s. And I said, I should be able to do field geology until at least 60. I actually made it to over 80. So that was the first thing I learned. The second very important thing I learned was about how to build up the physical skills and the confidence of my student associates. Okay, so as a party chief, I had to work with patience and with gradual training and encouragement, just like a coach, fulfills the technical and the emotional needs of a team of young athletes. Okay, I had to do the same thing. And then the third thing that was even more unexpected is every idea I've had in science and the occasional witty title for a paper came to me when I was out running and not thinking about anything. These ideas would just pop into my head. It's just the most amazing thing. And people used to laugh at me, but more and more people, finding that this is true. And I tell you, if you have a problem that you can't figure out, go for a walk, okay? And you may come up with a solution before you're out the door. So this was what the area looked like in a simplified map after we were done with it. Took about 15 years of work. So this is the continental margin. This is the edge of the shelf here. The light to the darker blue. The brown is sediment that came out when the continental margin collided with a volcanic arc. With an oceanic arc here is this green and red stuff is when the slab broke off. It was a west dipping slab. That's a part of the ocean that formerly existed between the arc and the continent, which slid back into the interior of the earth by a west-dipping slide, and it gave rise to this volcanic arc. And then as a result of that collision, the arc wouldn't go down because it was too buoyant, and so the subduction flipped. And now you had an east-dipping subduction zone out here, which you can see in the geophysics. And this is the younger volcanic arc of an Andean style, a continental margin arc. And this is just exactly the way you see today how continents are built. So Taiwan is an extension of the Luzon volcanic arc of the northern Philippines. And because the South China Sea is being consumed by east-dipping subduction under the Luzon volcanic arc, this arc is colliding and being added to the Eurasian plate here on the island of Taiwan. So Taiwan is a mountainous island because it's a collision zone. And then here is the reverse, the flipped subduction, now west-dipping underneath the Ryukyu arc, with the Taiwan, for the older parts of Taiwan arc, now buried to the north. And the whole collisional process is migrating southward over geologic time at a rate of about 2.5 from the southern part of Taiwan to the northern part is about 2.5 million years. Well, because of the success in discovering a 2 billion year old continental margin, I was tasked to compile the Precambrian geology of North America, including Greenland, for a decadal project organized by the Geological Society of America. And this is basically the result. So if you take off the sedimentary cover, this is the Canadian Shield here, but you can see underneath the cover from areas that pop up and from geophysics and whatnot. So it turns out that the interior of North America, just like Eurasia, is an aggregate of formerly independent continents. So the Slave, the Ray, the North Atlantic, the Hearn, the Superior, and the Wyoming were all former fragments of previous aggregates that broke up, dispersed, and then re-aggregated around 1.9 to 1.6 billion years ago. And it turns out that this aggregation process involved all the other continents as well. So it was a supercontinent, as it's called. That is, all the continents clustered together in one area. And so continents are like human populations. You know, they're different groups that came at different times from different places with different histories. Okay? And of course, now this model was then later confirmed by paleomagnetic evidence. So from paleomagnetism, you can determine what latitude a rock formed at, that is the distance from the pole, and also the direction to the pole. You can't tell what longitude you're on, however. You can tell what latitude you are and where the pole was in terms of direction, but you can't tell where you are in longitude. So paleomagnetists always plot the pole to the continent rather than the continent itself, because of course the pole doesn't have a longitude. Okay, the pole is at all longitudes. And so what basically the red is this province here. So this is the path of the pole to the Slave province, the red one. The blue, this is the Superior, this is the path of the poles of progressively younger ages. And so the coming together of the poles is reflective of the coming together from great distances apart of the continents. And so that confirms this was an independent test of the idea that these constituents of the aggregate actually were separated by large oceans, which then subsequently closed and collided. Now, geologists can also tell which way the wind blew in the distant past. And because at the time of the, at around 1860, you can see the pole was a long way from the Slave province. That meant the Slave province was at very low latitude in the deep tropics. And the deep tropics, the wind always blows in the same direction, right? It's always easterly, it's day and night. The trade winds always blowing from the east, unless there's a hurricane. But at all of the times you have easterly. So in the Slave province, using these criteria for the wind direction, it turned out that the winds were blowing in the wrong direction. Okay, if that pole that was shown in the last diagram, if this pole here was a north pole, then the wind should have been blowing from present northeast to southwest, but they were going in the opposite direction. So we figured it's a lot easier to just turn North America upside down, or at least the Slave province upside down, than it is to reverse the direction of rotation of the Earth. Let's obey the law of conservation of angular momentum. So as it turns out, this was a supercontinent that formed at that time. This is North America, and it's now always plotted upside down because of the wind directions. And so I called this Nuna, the supercontinent, because Nuna is the Inuit or Eskimo term for the land, meaning any land south of the Arctic Ocean. And of course, that's all the land there is south of the Arctic Ocean. So I thought that was a good name for this either first or second supercontinent. And it turns out that there's been a succession of supercontinents, average about 700 million years apart. And I think what happens is that if you get subduction in one area, this is the sinking of the cold ocean floors in one area, the ambient mantle is cooled, so it starts to sink. And so things tend to be drawn towards that sinking area. And the continents tend to cluster together like leaves above a grate. Okay, and they cluster together, but when they come all together, then they're now forming an insulating blanket. You know, no more cold ocean crust can go to sink in that area, and the continents have a lot of radioactivity in them, and so it's an insulating blanket. And so over about 200 million years or so, that downwelling area turns into an upwelling in response to sinking somewhere else where there's active subduction. And that upwelling then raises the supercontinent and weakens it thermally, and there's traction radiating away from it, and eventually then it disintegrates and breaks up and then flows to wherever the best sinking area is and re-aggregates. And so it turns out that there's been this succession of supercontinents over time. There's previously thought there was one called Pangaea that formed around 300 million years ago, started to break up about 180 million years ago to form the present Atlantic and the Indian and the Southern Oceans. But it turns out there's been a succession. Okay, so this is the most recent one. This is Pangaea. And incidentally, North America, for whatever reason, has been doing this continual counterclockwise rotation. And because at the present time, the Pacific Ocean is closing and all the other oceans are opening, the Atlantic, the Indian, and the Southern Oceans are all opening, the Pacific Ocean is closing. So if you consider Eurasia as a fix, if you fix Eurasia, then basically what's happening is the Americas are rotating clockwise, okay? And eventually, in about 200 million years, the Pacific will close, Australia's moving northward, we'll already be in, and we will have the next supercontinent, which I called Amasia. This is an Australian reconstruction. As you see, Australia is like a little joey in the pouch of a roux. Well, everything then came screeching to a halt because in 1984, the Conservatives won a landslide victory in federal elections in Canada. And they didn't fire all the civil servants, but they defunded the Geological Survey of Canada and many, many other government agencies. The people were still there, but there was no money to do any fieldwork. And regional scale geological mapping ended in Canada and has actually never been revived on a regional scale. And so, of course, what usually happens under conditions like this is the good people leave and the people who aren't doing anything, they stay. And so this gave me an opportunity for a new career, because I was looking already for life after tectonics. I could sense that the excitement of the plate tectonic revolution was starting to wane. And I thought to myself, what's going to be the new good thing? And the first Greenland ice cores had just come out, just been published, okay? And it's 1989. And that meant that we were now going to have annual resolution climate records for the last 100,000 years. So I said to myself, you know, climate science is going to get serious. And with the, you know, with the by then accepted issue of carbon dioxide greenhouse, I thought, well, you know, I had good luck extending plate tectonics to, you know, deep time, why don't I try doing the same thing with climate? So what these data showed was something very interesting, and this is the actual depth, and this is an age model that compensates for the fact that the ice becomes more compacted with depth. and so that the younger part is more expanded. So you can look at whatever side. The important thing is that during the last 10,000 years, this is the present interglacial period, there's variability in the inferred temperature, inferred from oxygen isotopes, but the variability is much smaller by a factor of 2 or 3 than what it was during the Ice Age. Okay, the climate variability was much greater when there was more ice. And the question is, why is that? And the reason is because of what we call ice albedo feedback, okay, which is a partly correct name. The albedo part of it corresponds to the fact that when sunlight falls on ice, the ice reflects 60 to 90% of the solar energy is reflected and lost. Whereas if it fell on seawater, 80 or 90% of it would be absorbed. And that would warm the water, which would then radiate and warm the air. Okay? So the presence of ice makes any change in climate greater. Okay? If it gets colder, you get more ice. And so there's an additional cooling effect just due to the increased area of sea ice. And similarly, if it gets warmer, you have less sea ice, so there's less loss of solar radiation. So there's an additional warming effect that's called the feedback. Now, you might think that this albedo feedback would only operate in the summertime. What about the winter in the Arctic when there's no sunlight? Well, it turns out that in the winter, the presence of sea ice is even more important. It's in fact much more important, because the presence of sea ice shields the air from the warmth of the water. Okay, the water represents an enormous reservoir, okay, enormous thermal inertia in the climate system, far larger than anything else. And if you have a thin coating of sea ice, it's like an insulation. And the air can barely feel the warmth of the water. There's a little bit from by diffusion through the ice, but most. So the cooling effect in winter is maybe 30 degrees, whereas the cooling effect in summer is might be 5 degrees. Okay, so it's a very strong feedback. Now, the interesting thing about this feedback is when scientists first put numbers on a simple energy balance equation, you know, the energy coming in from the sun must equal the energy that the Earth itself is radiating to have a stable climate. They found something very interesting, and that it results from the fact that the Earth is a sphere. So for every increment that the sea ice margin advances, every kilometer, every 100 kilometers, the area that is covered becomes larger and larger. So the feedback becomes bigger and bigger. And what came out of these numerical models, first done by a Soviet scientist, Mikhail Budiko, and at the same time and independently by an American, William Sellers, in Tucson, Arizona, is that there's a tipping point. And the tipping point is not much equatorward for the sea ice margin that existed at the last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago or so. And at that tipping point, the feedback becomes self-sustaining and is unstoppable until the ice margins meet at the equator. And when they meet and they're converging, that allows the sea ice to thicken to hundreds of meters depth, probably initially around a kilometer or more, and then, and so that means the ocean goes completely dark. And yet at that time, there were no land plants. There may have been some microbial life on land, although that's uncertain. Most primary producers were in the oceans. And most primary production, of course, uses solar energy to fix carbon. Okay. So now, this was a discovery in climate physics. Geologists had no idea that, that this discovery, this instability, this tipping point from ice albedo feedback came into existence. So let me back off and now look at the geological side of the history. So geologists know very, very well how to tell where glaciers were long after the ice has already disappeared, okay? By the nature, the very particular nature of the deposits that glaciers leave behind, Okay, so here, this is on Baffin Island. I took this photograph in 1990. So here is a glacier that's receding, but this is the deposit that's left behind, which is forming a dam here, damming up this lake. And these deposits here, called moraine or called till, have an unusual character. And that is that the original definition of a till, it's an old Scottish farmer's term, for a stiff clay confusedly mixed with boulders. And the boulders are often polished and shiny, okay, rounded and polished. And the reason for this is that glaciers erode by two mechanisms, by abrasion, which produces the powder, and by plucking or quarrying. Because when a glacier goes over a hump on the rock, you get a pressure gradient, so you get melting on the upstream side and regelation or freezing on the downstream side. And so the upstream side is smooth and striated, and downstream side is craggy because, you know, blocks have been frozen around and then plucked up and carried by the glacier. Now the shear, by the weight of the glacier and the motion of the glacier over the fixed rock underneath, polishes, rounds and polishes those angular blocks until they become smooth and round like a cabochon. And of course the silt is like the emery of the lapidary. Okay, and so these are very, very distinctive features that allow geologists to recognize where they, and also the boulders tend to have facets which have striations, scratch marks going in various directions. These are where when a rock gets carried at the very base of a glacier over a hard rock surface, it gets gouged. Now, it turns out that about 100 million years before the Cambrian, that's a great explosion of animal fossils, glacial deposits are remarkably widespread. They're widespread on every continent. The few areas of the continents that don't have any, it's just because they don't have rocks of the right age. It's not because there was no ice there, it's just that there aren't any rocks of this age. And it turns out there were two of these glacial, and in many of these areas you can see the two discrete glaciations are there, and as we now know, these are the ages that they represent. So the first one lasted about 55 million years, and the second one somewhere between 4 and 15 million years. Now, the additionally odd thing about these glacial deposits was many of them were associated with thick successions of carbonate, calcium carbonate or calcium magnesium carbonate, limestone or dolomite. And because of the peculiar saturation chemistry of carbonates, carbonate always forms preferentially in the warmest part of the surface ocean. It doesn't matter whether the climate is cold or warm, you know, relatively speaking, the carbonates are always in the warmest area just because of basic saturation chemistry. So if you have glacial deposits in a thick succession of shallow marine carbonates, that means there were glaciers at sea level in the warmest areas of the surface ocean. So doesn't that mean that colder areas would be frozen as well? So obviously this was not a normal climate. And yet geologists had no explanation for this. And so they conjured up all sorts of, you know, lots of continental drift, you know, different continents going, racing across the poles at different times. You can imagine it would be quite a traffic jam. And also, of course, when this debate was going on, when it was first realized, they didn't know what the ages of these, so they didn't know that these were all, you know, correlative in time. But the biggest problem was that they didn't read any of the climate physics literature. Because the climate people had the explanation, but the climate people assumed that if the Earth was ever completely glaciated, you know, there would be no recovery. Yeah, if the Earth was like this, they thought there'd be no recovery, and so it could never have happened. Because if it had happened, you know, nobody'd be here at this lecture. So they never thought of talking to a geologist. Now. All that changed when a small group of planetary scientists at Ann Arbor, Michigan, led by Jim Walker, who was a South African-born ionosphere physicist turned, planetary atmosphere evolution guy, And he had a student named Jim Casting. And during Jim Casting's thesis defense, the question arose is they had developed the idea that because you need to have a balance between the carbon dioxide that is being emitted by volcanoes and the carbon dioxide that is being consumed by soil-forming processes that convert rock to soil and ultimately dissolve the CO2 and convert it into bicarbonate, which then is carried by rivers to the ocean and deposited as carbonate sediments, shells of organisms and the like. And they said, well, there must be a balance, and that creates a thermostat so that the CO2 always is self-adjusting to whatever level it needs to be to maintain a balance between the amount of carbon dioxide coming out of volcanoes and that is being consumed. And this was a fantastic idea because it explained why the Earth has had a broadly stable, with variation, climate, despite the fact that the sun has gotten brighter by 30% over solar system history. This was known as the dim early sun paradox. How could it be that the Earth has had a broadly stable climate, hasn't either got colder or warmer very much over that period, allowing evolution and life to evolve, despite the fact that our main source of energy is getting brighter and brighter all the time? And the answer to this is that because the soil, the consumption of CO2 by soil forming processes is itself temperature dependent. So if it gets warmer, the consumption rate goes faster and faster and prevents the CO2 from getting any higher. And conversely, if it gets colder, then the soil forming processes get slower and slower, you know, which stabilize. So the carbon dioxide levels self-adjust to whatever level is necessary to compensate. The CO2 goes lower and lower, compensate for the sun getting brighter and brighter. And that compensation mechanism is a thermostat, basically, that keeps the Earth habitable. And so the question that was asked of Jim during his thesis defense, well, what if this white Earth disaster that the climate models indicated, you know, should have happened? I mean, there were lots of papers written about, you know, this ice albedo instability, you know, bifurcation business, because the problem was, if it was so easy, why didn't it ever happen? And so Jim was asked, well, what if it did happen? And they thought about it, and they realized that if the Earth's surface was entirely frozen, there'd be no way of removing the carbon dioxide from the air, because carbon dioxide is only soluble in rainwater. It's not soluble in snow, okay? And then the ground is frozen, so there would be little or no soil forming processes. There might be some consumption in the oceans, but basically there would be hardly any uptake of CO2, so the CO2 that would continue to come out of volcanoes, because plate tectonics would continue. Plate tectonics doesn't care if the ocean has a skin of ice on it. The CO2 would continue to come out of volcanoes and accumulate. Okay. Now you'll need a lot of CO2 to overcome the high albedo, the whiteness, the reflectivity of the surface. You probably need about a tenth of the total atmosphere. So you would need to increase the carbon dioxide content by 3 orders of magnitude, approximately, from what it would take to create the snowball Earth in the first place. So that would take millions to tens of millions of years. Okay, but at some point, so initially the temperature would rise fairly rapidly because the temperature rises each increment for every doubling of CO2. So when CO2 is very low, it doesn't take long to double it. But as you get more and more CO2, it takes longer and longer to double it. So you get a nonlinear rise of CO2, and also the surface here darkens it. So at some point, you start to open up the ice at the equator and expose dark water. And so now you have the ice albedo feedback working in the opposite direction. And the whole thing deglaciates extremely rapidly, probably on a time scale of 1 or 2,000 years. Far faster than you can consume, ever hope to consume, that extreme overload of CO2 you have in the atmosphere. So the long snowball Earth, millions to tens of millions of years, should be directly followed by an extreme CO2 greenhouse with a dark absorbing surface. So it should be the hottest climate the Earth has ever experienced. So now, I heard about indirectly about this self-reversing snowball Earth idea from a guy named Joe Kirschfinger. I won't go into that. But most geologists thought this was completely nuts, and Joe himself said it was a nutty idea. But don't make any mistake, Joe thinks that some of his nuts will germinate and grow into stately trees, and this is one of them. But what drew me to it is that it makes predictions that can be tested with new data. The predictions are that the onset should be globally synchronous at low latitude, the termination should be globally synchronous at all latitudes, the duration should be extremely long, millions to tens of millions of years, and it should be immediately followed by an ultra CO2 greenhouse and associated global warming. And as of 2015, each of those predictions has turned out to be true. And the snowball hypothesis is now, fiercely fought initially, is now accepted by most experts in the area. So anyway, this idea, and first of all, I didn't believe it any more than anyone else, but I thought it was testable at least. And so I wanted to set up a new field project, first of all, to make sure that these were truly glacial deposits, and that they were really closely associated in time with the carbonate background sediments. There weren't, big gaps, stratigraphic gaps and whatnot. So I set up a new project, long-term project I thought it would be, like maybe 8 or 10 years. It turned out I spent 30 field seasons here in Namibia, on the west coast of Southern Africa. So of course, Southern Africa has a warm, wet side and a cool, very, very dry side because of the ocean gyres, and offshore, the western side is the Benguela Current, which is coming right off the circumpolar Southern Ocean. And so it's extremely cold, but it warms up, and so it's very dry. So this is a very arid country, large country, 1,000 kilometer long coastline without a single perennial river, except at the border. So this is the coast of Namibia, and this is the carbonate succession, which carries the two glacial deposits, and the geology is just beautifully exposed. And Namibia became independent, a multiracial representative democracy in 1990. I started working there, first visited in 92, started working there seriously in 93 with great support from the Namibian Geological Survey. It's a very mineral-dependent economy. So they have a very good geological survey. I had excellent support from them, and also with the permission of the landowners and the people living in the areas that I worked. It was a very welcoming, and I fell in love with Namibia, as field geologists tend to do with their field areas. So the predictions of Snowball Earth turned out to be true. So these are the uncertainty limits on the onset of the first onset and termination of the first glaciation. So it lasted 55 million years with the ocean completely dark, and then there's an intersnowball period, and then there's the shorter second one, and this is the one the onset of the second one is uncertain, but the others are pretty well. And then this is the more recent time scale. So this is the age of the dinosaurs, to give you an impression. So the duration of this first snowball is almost as long as the time from the dinosaurs to the present. Now, here's the problem. There are macroscopic multicellular algae. These are phototrophic eukaryotes that are well established in marine environments before, between, and soon after these two snowball events. And yet it's hard to imagine that they could have survived if the ocean was in 99.9% dark. In terms of 99.9% of its area would be in total darkness, perpetual darkness for millions of years. So how do you explain the survival? And not to mention the radiations of animal life, which started 60 to 100 million years after the second glaciation, the Ediacaran and Cambrian explosion. So here are the animals. The fossils all come in here, But molecular clocks say that the initial radiations of animal life occurred during the snowball periods, which are the blue bars there. So I think that what happened was exactly the same thing that's happening today. Today, organisms are moving poleward in response to global warming. I think that long before the snowball earth periods, there were mountains that were glaciated because of their high elevation. So this is Mount Chimborazo in Ecuador. It's almost sits right on the equator. And above 5,000 meters in 1802, when Alexander von Humboldt, Carlos Montúfar, and Aimé Bonpland famously visited and did the ecological zonation by elevation on Mount Chimborazo. Now, there are glaciers here. And so those glaciers today and those glacial environments are populated by very, very diverse microbial organisms. Bacteria, viruses, algae, fungi, micrometazoans, like little microscopic animals. There's a great diversity of life that lives in these glacial, end-glacial, superglacial, and periglacial environments at the tops of mountains and, of course, in the polar regions. And so I think when the snowball Earth happened, and it only takes about 200 years from the tipping point to total darkness, I think that those pre-adapted, ice cold adapted biomes, ecosystems, simply migrated in step with the ice margins to the equatorial zone on snowball Earth, which is the net sublimation zone on a frozen planet. So here are the sea glaciers, as we call them, coming in from each of the polar regions, and they meet at the equator. And this, for reasons I won't go into, is the one desert on snowball Earth. Snowball Earth only has one desert, not four deserts like the modern planet. And so here, dust, which is darker than snow, would accumulate at the surface, absorb sunlight, produce meltwater, and allow phototrophs and liquid water and nutrients and sunlight to coexist. And so I think what happened is those organisms moved to the equatorial zone and said, wow, this is great. Our habitat area is vastly larger, and the cruelty of winter is much reduced because they're now at the equator. When they live in the mountaintops or in the high latitudes, particularly those bits of liquid water, they freeze solid in the wintertime, but not so much at the equator. And so they flourished and evolved there. And when the snowball suddenly melted, they found themselves in the rapidly warming, nutrient-rich, meltwater-dominated lid of the surface ocean, mostly meltwater. And some went back to the mountaintops, and others restocked the vacant oceans. And so these are some of the environments that you see in the present day. On glaciers, and for example, in dry valleys in Antarctica that are covered by ice covered, but the ice is relatively thin because of the net sublimation. So there are lots of organisms, both benthic living on the lake bed and also in the water column there. Great diversity of organisms, and so I call this ecosystem relocation. I call it the Quito Express hypothesis. So that book my mother was reading to me could have been this book, which was published in 1938. It was a child's book about a baby who gets accidentally left on this train that goes back and forth between Quito in Ecuador and the equatorial coast city of Guayaquil. Okay, which is about 2 degrees south of the equator, right on the Pacific coast. It goes back and forth, and it goes right by the two heavily glaciated volcanoes of Chimborazo and also Cotopaxi. And it's two-way train, which is important for them. Okay. So where do we go from here? So the least known aspect of the snowball Earth phenomenon is the biological response. I've suggested a general hypothesis, but to test this in detail means to see whether all the constituents you need for the Ediacaran and Cambrian radiations that came after are present in these glacial environments. And more importantly, is that history of long pre, long before Snowball Earth, adaptation to these cold environments, and then quite late in microbial history, this restocking of the oceans, that history should be encoded in the genomes of living organisms. And that is by far the most enormous source of information in all of science, the genomes of all organisms. But we need to know and accept this geology to be able to interpret the genomics and all the other omics, the transcriptomics, the functionality of the of the various proteins and other, if we neglect Snowball Earth, we will not properly be able to interpret the genomes of modern organisms. And so this is where the future lies for Snowball Earth research. And also it will be, of course, a test. That I believe we can already start to see it in molecular phylogenetics of living organisms. But most of that work is for the future. And it will take time. And so even the youngest people in this audience will at least, if not participate, you'll be witness to revelations about the nature of living organisms reflecting this aspect of Earth's history. Okay, so I was lucky to encounter geology at an early age, and it never let me down. Thank you.
All right, we have time now to take some questions from the audience, and there's microphones set up, it looks like, on both sides. Go ahead.
When we read in the popular press or even in the popular science literature about CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases in the last few centuries, when they say it stays there for a couple hundred years, or in methane it's a few decades, what do those times mean? Is that like an e-folding time? Is it like 5 e-folding times to get you down to like 1% of whatever the initial hit was?
Yeah. About 85% of the carbon dioxide that is being emitted by human activities will be taken up by the ocean. And the rate-limiting step is the dissolution of calcium carbonate, mostly of coccolithophore ooze. Coccolith ooze is a tiny microscopic organisms that secrete calcium carbonate skeletons. And the carbon dioxide uptake of the ocean is rate-limited by dissolution of calcium carbonate. It's exactly the same as the antacid tablets you take if you have a stomach acidity. Those tablets are made up of ground up calcium carbonate, limestone. That's all it is. And what you learn when you take, if you have indigestion, is that first of all, you need to take several tablets. Okay, you need a lot of calcium carbonate. Secondly, you don't feel better right away. It takes a while. That's the few thousand years if you consider the ocean as a stomach. Okay, and thirdly, when you feel better, you do feel better, but you don't feel 100% better. You feel 85% better, okay? That's because the ocean only takes up about 85%. And the time scale is a few thousand years, which unfortunately is not socially very useful, right? And also, the ocean won't be very happy about it, okay? Because all that dissolution, lowers the saturation state of the ocean. So the organisms that precipitate calcium carbonate to make shells and houses, that makes it a lot harder for them. So there are questions about what happens to coral reefs, because it's anticipated that the saturations, that the surface ocean will become undersaturated with respect to calcium carbonate everywhere by about 2050. And if anything, we're going to arrive sooner because everything is going faster than most projections. Now, the last 15%, that will be taken up by the soil forming processes that I mentioned that Jim Walker studied, and that will be on a much longer time scale. That's on a time scale of some hundreds of thousands of years. Okay? So the point is that this perturbation in CO2 which we're responsible for, with its many feedbacks, including everything that's going to be released from the boreal forest and in Canada and the permafrost, that's going to be with us on geological timescale. It's a truly geological phenomenon. Okay, but not, it won't be forever. But it will be long lasting.
Yeah, let's take a question next from the other side of the room. You're right here.
Yeah, thank you. So can we ensure that all the common characteristics we see on different living beings all around the world is due to the fact that we all descended from the same survivals of the snowball Earth era?
That's a very good question for the future. We only have little hints at what the implications would be for the nature or behavior of living organisms, the fact that they experienced it. Let me give you one example. Between 5 and 10% of global primary production are organisms that are about a micron in size. Okay, that's a micrometer, a millionth of a meter. So these are very, very tiny single-celled organisms. And there are two different genera. One is called Pro, short for Prochlorococcus, and the other is called Syn, short for Synecococcus. And they are the dominant primary producers in the open ocean gyres, far from land, because they're slow growing, but where there's nutrient starvation, they're pretty competitive. When there is like upwellings that are more nutrients, they don't grow fast enough to compete with more evolved organisms like algae. But they're nevertheless globally important. Now, one of the puzzles is that Pro only is found in the deep tropics, whereas Syn occurs at all latitudes and occurs in extreme abundance in polar, including polar lakes and in nutrient-starved areas of the polar ocean, but mostly in the polar inland sea. So the question is, why is Pro only in the tropics? And it turned out that it experienced a massive gene reduction event. This is an event when genes that are not being used for anything, are lost. It just makes the organism more streamlined. Incidentally, these tiny single-celled organisms, Pro is only a half a micron in diameter, has a genome that is 4 times larger than the human genome. That's why microorganisms are so adaptable, because they have way more functionality than we do. Okay, they have a much bigger toolkit. But it's cumbersome. And so if there's a chance, and so when they did a molecular clock analysis to see when this gene reduction event occurred, sure enough, it was 680 million years ago, during the first snowball. And guess what? It was living at the equator. And one of the genes it lost was one of the 3 genes that all phototrophs used to control the circadian rhythm. That means a function that tells the photosynthesis machines to start going before the first light of dawn. And because these are mixotrophs, they do heterotrophy and cell division at night to turn those machines off, before the last light at sunset. Okay, so you need that to, because these are, complex machines. Now, it turns out that Pro lost one of those 3 genes when it was at the equator on snowball Earth, because it didn't need it. Because if you're at the tropics, you only need 2 chi genes, just like an hourglass, because the day length doesn't change very much over the course of the year. But at higher latitudes, the day length is, like in the Arctic, the day length is changing anywhere from 0 to 24 hours. And so you need a Rolex. You need 3 chi genes. Okay. So that's just one very small example of how this experience of snowball Earth and events that happen because of that situation constrain, the habitat area of an important organism to the present day. And I'm sure we'll find many, many more examples like this.
All right, next over here.
I understand that ice stuff would have been very great during this time, but given that plate tectonics existed, is there any evidence of chemoautotrophic communities present, like how we see in hydrothermal vents or cold methane seeps during this time?
Well, there's no direct evidence, but we assume that the deep hot biosphere, the organisms that are living within the crust, may not have even known there was a snowball Earth. Deep sea hydrothermal vent communities. Okay. Now, this is a bit trickier. At the time when the snowball Earth occurred, the deep part of the oceans were anoxic everywhere. Okay. So that means that from the standpoint of their redox potential, you know, their oxidation reduction potential, there was no gradient between the seawater and the hydrothermal vent fluids. Hydrothermal vent communities today use both the thermal energy, but also the redox gradient as a source of energy. They wouldn't have had that. And also during the snowball Earth period, you know, lasting millions of years, the ocean is not feeling much influence from the continents because, you know, the atmosphere is so cold. There is a hydrologic cycle, but it's extremely slow. And so there's much less erosion of the continents than would normally be. And so as a result, the ocean seawater starts to more and more closely resemble an average vent fluid. And so you're losing the chemical gradients, which deep sea hydrothermal vent communities also use as a source of energy, because the seawater is becoming more and more like a vent fluid. So they wouldn't be very happy, let's put it that way.
We should have time for another question or two.
Hi, I'm Obi from Chula Vista High School. Our question is, of all the places on Earth to try and study snowball hypothesis, what drew you to Namibia?
that's really an excellent question. So I wanted what reported glacial deposits in a thick carbonate succession that was very well exposed, which had not been studied very much. And as it turned out, Namibia, because of the civil war leading to independence, there had been almost no work done there for 10 or 20 years. But I also wanted a place that I thought would be politically stable, because I knew it would be a long-term project. Okay, and I don't want to be working and taking students to a war zone. And so I was very impressed by the wise action of the new incoming government in Namibia under the leadership of the late Sam Nujoma, who just died a week or so ago, who was the founding president of Namibia. And incidentally, he got so interested in geology because of the mining in Namibia when he was president, that when he retired at the age of 70 from the presidency after his two elected term limits, he enrolled as a freshman at the University of Namibia, and he eventually got a master's degree in geology. Yeah. And so, when Namibia became independent, they took, I thought, very wise actions. And so I just felt that there was a good chance that this would be a stable country. And I received a strong encouragement from the Namibian Geological Survey, which, because of the importance of mining for their economy, which is well developed. Namibia is much better mapped than Canada, incidentally. And so I had excellent topographic maps, you know, air photos, because satellite images weren't very good in those days. So I had strong encouragement. They had a good geological community. They had excellent library, universities. The only sad part of it was that when you work in the subtropical deserts, geologists work in deserts because we want to see the rocks without vegetation. When you work in the subtropics, you have to work in the opposite hemisphere because you have to work in the winter. The summers are way too hot. I mean, even in the dead of winter, it's 35 degrees every day in Namibia. It's impossible in the summer. So the problem is that's the school year. So I could only have Namibian students with me on weekends or very short periods. I couldn't have them as long term, because it takes a while to get students, you know, trained so they can go out and do their own work independently. And that's when they learn. You know, you learn when you're given something and to do on your own. And my only regret about Namibia is not being able to have Namibian students with me in the field because of the conflict between the field season and the academic year. That's why the southwestern U.S. is one of the greatest field geological field areas on Earth, and yet is actually poorly known. And it's because of the conflict between, you know, there are 90 geology departments in California, and yet the Death Valley region, which is a gold mine, you know, even the rudimentary things are just being discovered because of this, you know, you can't do geology on weekends.
They're such fantastic questions. That's a crazy story about the Namibian president. I'm just trying to imagine right now having a former two-term president enrolling in one of my college classes and grading their homework.
Sam Nujoma is a very impressive man.
That's a crazy story. Well, we are unfortunately out of time now, so let's all thank our speaker again.
And let's thank the Inomori.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.